The South will definitely declare independence on July 9th. I don't think anything will stop that. The question is, will they have their independence at a time when the North and South are in a cooperative relationship with each other? That's the key.
And that's U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Princeton Lyman, on the PBS NewsHour, expressing confidence that South Sudan will declare independence this Saturday, July 9th. In January, the people of South Sudan voted by more than 98% for independence from North Sudan, but escalating violence in the disputed border areas between those two regions has displaced thousands of people and raised fears that a civil war could resume. Later this hour, we'll talk with two Ohio State University alumni who were refugees of Sudan's second civil war and are now U.S. citizens living in central Ohio. First, we're going to talk with Scopas Pogo. He's an assistant professor of African American and African Studies at the OSU Mansfield campus. Professor Pogo is a specialist in 20th century history of Sudan, and he's the author of The First Sudanese Civil War, Africans, Arabs, and Israelis in the Southern Sudan, 1955. To 1972. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you very much indeed, Anne Fisher.
Until South Sudan becomes independent from the North on Saturday, Sudan is the largest country on the African continent with incredible geographic diversity that you can see from space. Deserts in the north and jungles and swamps in the south. Where did you grow up, and tell us what it's like? Help us picture Sudan right now.
I was born in Kajukeji County, which is a small county in central equatorial region, central equatorial state of South Sudan, in the mid-1960s. And I spent 4 years in Kajukeji before my parents fled to Uganda together with me and my siblings. And we spent several years in Uganda until the peace agreement was signed, which was called the Addis Ababa Peace Agreement, that ended the first civil war in the Sudan that had ensued between the Southern Sudanese Resistance Movement, the Anyanya, and the Sudan Armed Forces. And upon my return to the Sudan, I actually studied at the University of Juba.
That will be the capital of the new country.
Yes, which is actually the capital of the new country, mm-hmm. The new emerging country. And I studied at the University of Juba, and to put things into context, the Sudan being the largest country in Africa has actually diversity in terms of race, ethnicity, culture, and religion. The people in the northern part of the Sudan include Africans, people of African descent, who over time had embraced Islamic faith, but they also retain their traditional values, norms, as well as some traditional religious belief systems. The Arabs, who originally came from Saudi Arabia and Egypt, entered the Sudan either in pre-Christian era or after the introduction of Islam to North Africa in the 7th century. And as they settled in the northern part of the country, they interacted through force and sometimes through peaceful means, and they married the African women. So that in the north today, we have a diverse group of people in that part of the country. We have those who call themselves Arabs, and they trace their ancestry to Saudi Arabia. And there are those who still call themselves Arabs, but they're actually of mixed race. They are, on one hand, they have actually African blood, but on the other, they also have Arab blood. And then the third group is the Africans, the indigenous Africans, whom the Arabs found in the northern part of the country, in places today we call Darfur, South Kordofan, Southern Blue Nile, and the Bija people in the eastern region of the Sudan. So up to the present time, you'll find that there are actually more people of African descent in the northern part of the country in terms of population. But if it is in terms of Arabic speaking, the majority of the people in northern Sudan speak Arabic. Whereas in the southern Sudan, or the region that is soon to become the new Republic of South Sudan, the people there belong to various ethnic groups. There are more than 60 ethnic groups that have actually been recorded. They have various traditional values, norms, they speak different languages, and before the coming of the British, as well as Roman Catholic and other missionaries from Australia and the United States to South Sudan during the British era, most of the people in South Sudan embrace different religious belief systems. Some worship ancestral spirits, others gods and goddesses. And when Christianity arrived in South Sudan, some southerners during the colonial period did convert to Christianity, but the vast majority continued with their traditional religious belief systems. But
go ahead.
Right now, that has changed, especially when southern Sudanese fled to Uganda, Kenya, the Congo, and other neighboring countries during the First and Second Civil Wars. Many of them converted to Christianity, so that there's now a large population of southern Sudanese who subscribe to various Christian denominations.
Do the same things that separate the country now, the same differences, the same conflicts, are they the same conflicts that separated them in the first Sudanese Civil War from 1955 to 1972, and then the second Sudanese Civil War from 1983 to 2005, or have the issues changed over time?
Most of the problems that actually separated the North and the South can be traced way back to the Turco-Egyptian era when the Turks occupied the Sudan in 1821, and then they subsequently went to South Sudan to capture men, women, and children who were enslaved and shipped to Egypt. That was actually the program of Muhammad Ali, who was trying to modernize Egypt at the time. That's one issue that existed and actually was also a critical factor that brought about the rise of the Anyanya, the resistance movement in the South. And the same problem that pertains to slavery also resurged during the Second Civil War from 1988, and it actually continued on until the Civil War ended, until the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. The other root causes of the war between the North and the South are actually political, and many of them are related to the colonial British administration in the Sudan. When the British had established the administration in the Sudan, they separated the South. They literally separated the South from the North. And so you see there was actually a boundary, an arbitrary boundary that was drawn between the North and the South, which has become a point of contention in the present time. And the reason was to separate, the reason for separating the South from the North was because the British, on one hand, did not want Islam to spread to South Sudan. They did not want Islam to continue either to spread to its colonial possessions in southern part of Africa, east and central part of Africa. The British wanted to keep the southerners away from the northerners. Instead, they wanted Christianity to be spread to South Sudan. That was one critical issue.
Okay. My guest is Professor Scopas Pogo from OSU's Mansfield campus. He is a professor of African American and African Studies. We're talking about Sudan and the coming New Republic of South Sudan, which becomes a new country on Saturday. If you have a question or comment for Professor Pogo, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. So, Professor, go on. Did I interrupt you?
Oh, thank you very much. So when the South was literally separated from the North, the British established its administration in the North and also introduced governmental institutions in the North. They established schools, and the Northerners were encouraged to go to school, whereas in the South, education was left in the hands of the Christian missionaries who had established churches and mission schools across the South. And so while the North advanced in terms of education, the South lagged behind in every way. And as far as development was concerned, the British policy, which became defined in the 1930s, and that was ultimately called the Southern Policy, did not encourage development, economic development in the South. The policy emphasized more on what the British colonial administration called care and maintenance. A small army was actually established in the South that was to keep law and order, that was to prevent the Southerners from poaching animals like elephants and others. And the South was basically left, kept in what sometimes is described by politicians, Southern politicians, as animals in a cage. So that for much of the period of the British rule in South Sudan, the South did not witness any kind of development.
What was the thought behind not developing? What, was it just to extract wealth from the country and not bother investing in it because it would just be an unnecessary expense to them? What was why did the British take on, have that
when
policy?
British, thank you. When the British first occupied the Sudan, it was a joint venture between the British and the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a venture that was called the condominium, in which case Egypt and Britain were to administer the Sudan jointly. And so any attempt to start a development project in the South or any other part of Eastern or Southern or Western Sudan would require the approval of funds from Egypt. And the Egyptians did not have the British who had also occupied Egypt, who ruled Egypt, did not have the money for the development of Southern Sudan per se, and so that was one of the reasons why the South lagged behind. The other reason was that when the British missionaries arrived in the South to administer the Southern Sudanese people, they determined that the South was a worthless, quote-unquote, real estate, that much of the South was vast. There were vast, swampy areas in the South. They didn't see the South as being viable economically. And so there was no attempt, no serious attempt to survey the South for mineral resources. And so the South was basically left on their own. At one point, the British Governor General actually argued that the South should be left, the people of the Southern Sudan should be left as they have been in previous centuries, that very little should be done to interfere with their culture or with their day-to-day way of life.
My guest is Professor Scopas Pogo. He is at the Mansfield campus of The Ohio State University, where he teaches African American and African Studies. If you have a question or comment for him, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. He'll be joining us a little later in the program. Coming up, we'll hear from Bola Wang and Jack Dow. They are former Lost Boys of Sudan. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, with the last space shuttle on the launch pad, we'll look at America's future in space. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 o'clock here on 89.7 NPR News. It's 81 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:21 this morning. Mostly sunny skies this afternoon and a warm day, a high near 90. There is a slight chance of a pop-up shower. Also, that slight chance of rain for tonight, a low of 69 degrees. Partly sunny for Friday with a slight chance of rain and a high of 86. And still that slight chance of rain for Friday night, a low of 66 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the challenges coming up for the new Republic of South Sudan. The Republic of South Sudan comes into being technically on Saturday. We were talking with historian OSU historian Professor Scopus Pogo. Joining us now are Bol Owang and Jack Dow. They're cousins who, as children, were forced to flee their village in South Sudan. They survived lion attacks, death squads, near drowning, squalor, deprivation, and many years as refugees. Now have both have graduated from OSU, Bol with a degree in fine arts and Jack with a degree in political science. They've become American citizens as well. And welcome to the show, Bol.
Thank you so Pleasure much.
I should say welcome back, Bol, and also welcome, Jack.
Pleasure to be with you.
You both were only 6 years old when your village in South Sudan was attacked during the Second Sudanese Civil War. Jack, how did you escape? What happened?
It was a horrific moment, the time that I escaped. Mm-hmm. As you just learned about the civil war in Sudan, that was just happened in South, so our village was attacked at that time.
The war was only happening in the South.
Correct.
Right.
And our village was attacked on the day that I left. So I escaped on that night. When we were attacked, I left. I would not ask where my mom is or my dad, so I just ran away on myself. The next morning, what happened is there were some people also who were also hiding behind, and they tried to find out who is there. So I came out and I met with some people. Uncle was there, and we didn't make it back to the village because the village was burned down and nobody was there. People flee. And after that one, then I was told that I asked about my parent, but no one has an answer. They say they are okay, but I knew they just giving me the answer. That was not true. They were not even sure where were they. And that time, then, we were told, let's go. So the journey was intended to be Ethiopia. And that moment, we don't know where the Ethiopia.
You're 6 years old.
Correct. So we just set off, and that's how we set off to Ethiopia for refuge.
Bol, when you were young, when you were 6 years old and when that happened, it happened very suddenly. Did you know there was a war going on? Did you know that this might happen, that there might be an attack like this? What did your parents talk to you about it at all?
Yeah, my parents were talking about it, and I was not really aware what was going on. I was
You're
confused.
You're a kid, yeah.
Yeah, I just heard that people are talking, something is going on, and what was it, and what is the nature of war? I didn't have the right picture of the what the war is like until when I see the tank coming into my village, and I see and the time when the airplane dropped the bomb and the soldiers were firing the gun, that's when I really find out that okay, this is the war, and this does not involve only the sound of gun; it involves the loss of life, and that's the time I miss my family. I was not able to see my parent, mom, until 20 years later. So I just ran away, and I thought maybe I will come back in a few minutes, in an hour, in a day or a week, but there was no sign of that. So when I was in hiding, when I look back, what I see is smoke rising in the village. What I see was the burning village. What I heard was sound of gun. So there was no chance for me to go back into the village, and there's no way for me to find my family members. So I just follow who is going to the safe place until I found myself in Ethiopia refugee camp. So I just followed the group, and where they were going, I didn't have idea what is the Ethiopia, what I don't know anything. I just followed the group, and my feeling was, where is my family? When can I meet them again when I come back to the village? When will this thing be over?
Jack, you didn't start out together, actually. It was a few days or a few weeks later that you connected with each other?
Correct.
You and Bull?
Yeah, on the time that we fled the village, we didn't catch up together. Bull was 1 month behind me on our way to Ethiopia. So the first month I arrived in Ethiopia, and this next month Bull came, and that's when we catch up in Ethiopia. But on the way, Bull was coming with another group, and it was a continuous journey. Every village after village will be attacked, and those people will be forced to flee to Ethiopia. And that was the only way that the people should have to get out of the country, because that's when the Sudan People Liberation Army have liberated some of the town. So it should be the only way that you can escape the country.
My guests are Bola Wang and Jack Dow. They are now American citizens after graduating from Ohio State University. And as children were forced to flee their village in South Sudan, they survived all kinds of attacks, all kinds of deprivation. And if you have a question or comment for them about their experience, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm wondering now, as adults, when you look back at yourselves as six-year-olds. Now, we're always referring to the Lost Boys of Sudan, and it almost feels a little ridiculous sometimes, but it does set in our mind very specifically who we're talking to and what we're talking about. But when you look back at yourselves as just babies, 6 years old, what do you think? Do you remember and think back to those days and what was going through your mind, Bull?
Yeah, I refer back a lot on the day when I was in the jungle, when I had no food to eat, when I have to run away from the lions. I have to go back to those days and to evaluate my life, where I'm going. Like, sometimes it is easy to get lost in life, but in order to encourage myself, I have to go back. If I manage the life of lion and stay spending some days without food, then I could be able to manage my life here in U.S. And as I grow up, like when I came to U.S., I did not just come here and say, oh, this is U.S., this is where you find all the food that you need. I knew that you can find a food, but you need to find the food that will last, not the food that you eat today and get satisfied and that's it. You need to find the food that you eat tomorrow, you eat next year, and you eat the following year. Which means that I have to go to school and I have to be able to find a permanent job that will support me and that will support somebody in my family. And I have to think also that when I come from that country where there was war, I have to do something that will help that country sometime in the future. That's why I'm now I'm working on medical clinics so that I have to help people in my village. People have no chance to get medical education, some medical supplies somewhere, or people who have no food, who wake up in the morning and they got no food and they spend the next day without food. So I have to do something here. If I'm able to help one person here, two people there, three people, a community, if I'm able to do that, I will do it. But the reason for that is the life that I have been through. When I was spending the day without food, I feel like that if there's a way that I should not make somebody spend the day without food, if I'm able to provide food to somebody, then I have to do it, because I know the pain of the hunger when I was 6 years old. So I don't need anybody to feel that pain if I'm able to do something. The same things, I got sick a lot when I was there, and I did not get any treatment. But if there's a way that I can provide medicine to somebody who is sick today, I could do it, because I learned through example. The trauma that I went through, I don't need somebody to go through that trauma again.
Chuck Dow, when you look back at yourself as a six-year-old boy, scared to death, being chased by lions, crocodiles.
Yeah, those were the memories that is still up to this moment. But they will come down on the July 9 because we achieved what we were suffering for. So all the memories of the long distant walks, of the severe hunger that we passed, the horrific death and the killings that we saw, and all some other stuff that you knew might happen in the war zone will be wind down as people will be so happy to celebrate July 9. And I'm so happy, and I will not be looking back of all the horrible things that I went through, because the cause that made those one happen to me has been achieved. And when we left as a 6 years old, we took our own responsibility into our hand. So, and that taught us to be so responsible when we were very young. Because before I left the village, I knew my mom is there to find a food for me. My dad is there to provide a family with food. But the moment I became by myself, then I should be the one to think of what I will eat in the morning, what I should have to do. Where can I find the clothes? The sun is too hot for me, so what I should have to do? A chase from the crocodiles in the river when people are crossing, the lions, and also things that can support a life when we were there. And my friend thinks, what should I have to do? I'm now not feeling good. Whom should I have to ask for help? All those things when we were there taught us to be a different kid compared to some kid in the United States and some other places. So when we when we were in the refugee camp, we have insufficient things that we live day and night. And after that on, we knew we have a hope that war will come to an end, as some people must talk about, as a professor talked before about the past civil war in Sudan. We were not born. But those children during that time were told that it will come to an end, and that's when they signed the Addis Ababa Agreement in 1972. So we were also told by the people whom we were together that the war will come to an end. But when? It might be 40 years, 20 years, 30 years as it happened. But there was a hope that things will come to the normal life as people came. So when we became fortunate to be selected to come to the United States, it opened a window for us to be people that have a dream to achieve where we are today, going to school, come and find a job, of which we spent 14 years in a refugee camp doing nothing. But when we came over here, everybody was so happy to push themselves into the work ethic in the United States and learn everything that they could to make that life easier. So all these things, we just see it differently compared to the people of the United States here. When we're here, what do you see at the workplace and what kind of the work that you do? The work that I will be doing since I came here will not be something that I will be complaining about. But a person like you might be complaining that you are doing too much work, or which is it's totally different if you came from where I came, where I saw everything has happened day and night. A woman might be walking 15 miles to 20 miles to go and fetch water or firewood. While you are here, you have a stove and you just go to the nearest retailers and go and buy your groceries and come here. For me to spend 8 hours at work will not be the same as the person that is now spending 8 hours in the palm all day long with no break, because that's the only life. So things were so different when we came over here, as Boli stated before, and we see that opportunities here, which most of the people here will not see because they have never been to outside to compare their life. And that's how we make it to be at this moment.
Marjorie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm on the air?
You're on the air, Marjorie. Welcome to the show.
I better turn my TV down.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to say...
It's still up too loud, Marjorie.
Okay.
Yeah, why don't you just turn it off? There you go.
First of all, I'm so happy to have tuned in. I'm so happy to have tuned in to see these two young men, and I just have to express to them how brave I think they are. And one of the reasons I'm calling is to find out if they could give the name of an organization and, if possible, the internet address or the phone number that we could use to send donations to help the people in their country.
Boli or Jack, one of you like to tell us where people can send it? And, of course, we'll also, Marjorie, put information on our website as well. But, Boli, you want to tell us?
Yeah, our website is sudanclinic.org.
Sudanclinic.org.
Yeah. And you can also find us on Facebook, Lost Boy of Sudan on Facebook.
Okay. Marjorie,
Sudan
does that help?
Clinic.
Oh, Marjorie's off. So,
I want to congratulate these two young men for their bravery and their courage. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, Marjorie. Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Michelle, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Ann. My name's Michelle, and I'm calling from Worthington. I just want to make a comment regarding these two remarkable young gentlemen. I've met Boli before. I've not met Jack. And I would like Boli to just let your listeners know about his wonderful paintings that he has done that have sort of documented his journeys. I've seen slides of his work, and they're quite remarkable. So I'd just like Boli to comment on that a little bit.
Yeah, just a quick aside, though, Jack, political science just doesn't play the same way that art does.
I know that.
Boli, you've done amazing work. I've seen it before. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it, and maybe we can post some of that on the website, too.
All right. Thank you so much, Michelle, for your compliment. My art is about the journey of Lost Boy of Sudan. I have illustrated all the images about what we have been through, the lion chase, the journey that we walk through in the jungles, and what kind of food we eat over there, and all the other incidents that took place on our way, including the crossing of the Gilo River, which was the worst thing, worst event that we faced when we returned from Ethiopia back to Sudan. So I have a lot of images, and you will be able to see all those images on my website, bolawing.com, and I'm available here in Columbus to share my PowerPoint with people who are interested to do to see more about it.
That's bolawing.com. And also, you spoke at the TEDx Columbus event last year, and that's still on the internet. So
yes.
If you go to TEDx Columbus, you can hear Boli talk about his experiences, and you can see a lot of his work too. So thank you, Michelle, for that call. We appreciate it. We're talking about Saturday, because on Saturday, the Republic of South Sudan becomes the 196th country in the world. Pretty exciting time. Boli has a beautiful polo shirt on with the Southern Sudan, the new flag. It's beautiful. And Jack is in complimentary blue shirt, so it's very colorful in here. If you would like to talk about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming back to join us will be Professor Scopas Pogo from the OSU Mansfield campus to talk more about what's coming up in South Sudan. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, starting at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins. We'll discuss cycling for your health, and also Fritz the Night Owl will be stopping by. Join us for All Sides beginning at 11. And you can join WOSU Public Media for a Chefs in the City coffee brunch at the Elegant Deepwood Restaurant. The event is Saturday, July 23rd at 10:30 a.m., and tickets are on sale now for $45 each. A handcrafted seasonal brunch will be presented by Chefs Brian Pollock and Amber Heron of Deepwood. Guests will also learn to make excellent coffee at home with Andy Luck of Luck Brothers Coffee House. Tickets are limited. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to reserve yours now. Proceeds from this and all Chefs in the City 2011 events directly support children's educational programming on WOSU-TV. And it's 81 degrees in Columbus. Sunny skies today, a high near 90. There is a chance of a pop-up shower. Also a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 69 degrees. Partly sunny for Friday, and a chance of showers still sticking around, a high of 86 degrees. Clouds Friday night, a low of 66. And then sunshine for Saturday, a high of 87. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the Republic of South Sudan, the new Republic of South Sudan. It will become so on Saturday, officially the 196th country in the world. If you have a question or comment for our guests, we welcome them, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We welcome back Scopas Pogo. Welcome back, Professor.
Oh, thank you very much.
Also with us, Bol Awang and Jack Dow, two of the lost boys of Sudan, now grown men, with lots to tell us about the future of Sudan. Let's just kick it off with Adam in Columbus. You're on the air. You've been waiting a while, and I appreciate your patience. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, Adam. Or it's Adama.
Hello, hello, okay. And thank you very much. I'm just calling to ask two questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is why they kept the name Sudan, because the root of the Sudan came from the word Arabic Eswat, means blood. That's the number one. And the number two, what is the language of teach the language they would be teaching their children? What language will be Arabic or their own language? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Adama. So Sudan, the origin of, why not have a whole new name for the country? Do you have any professor? Do you have a?
Yes. I've got an answer for Adam. Yes, historically, the what is today called Sudan was referred to by the Arabs who first visited that region as Belet al Sudan, which means the land of blacks, Belet al Sudan. And so, when Sudan became a modern nation, when it became actually a modern nation under the British, the name Sudan continued, and it will continue even in post-independent South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the North will retain the name Sudan, and there will be Northern Sudan, there will be North Sudan, there will be South Sudan.
So the North will change to North Sudan, is what its official name will be?
We're not sure exactly. It will be up to the North to determine if they will call it a different name, but I believe that the name Sudan will still remain for the North and the South, and it is because we want to keep, the South wants to keep the name Sudan because of historical and definitive character of the country. We have been linked together. The North and the South have been bound together by history. We've been bound together by the Nile, which actually flows from Uganda through South Sudan, Northern Sudan, and then subsequently into Egypt. So, and then it is also in the interest of the two new republics to actually cooperate with one another politically, economically, and socially so that they can coexist in peace with one another. There might also be possibilities for the two parts of the country to engage in bilateral agreements in trade and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think it is in the interest that there's North and the South will have to keep the name Sudan. The North and the South is still the land of the black people. There are blacks in the North, there are blacks in the South.
What about language? What do we know about that?
Language, with regard to language, the Legislative Assembly in Southern Sudan has actually approved English as the medium of instruction in school.
Well, I heard the new national anthem, which we played at the top, there was in English, and I thought, do they have different versions?
It is actually in English, and it is because English has actually been approved by the Legislative Assembly as the medium of instruction in schools, and also the language of administration in government offices as well as in the private sector. But Arabic will also be in wide use across the South because of the fact that historically Southern Sudanese have actually learned Arabic either in Juba or Wau, Malakal, or other small towns. And also Southerners who have gone to the North, who particularly went to the North during the Second Civil War and settled in Khartoum and other cities in the North, have actually learned Arabic. So that large numbers of Southerners are coming back. Many have already returned, but others are still coming back from the North. And many of them speak Arabic. They don't speak their local languages. They will have to relearn their mother tongue. So Arabic will remain as a lingua franca, if I may actually term it that way. But it is a localized kind of Arabic across the South.
Okay. Emmanuel in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Anna. What I want to know, talk about is, do we have other professors like the professor that is talking right now could go back to Sudan and establish an educational system that can make the country move forward? Not professors that have to go back for politics, because that's one of the things that they do. We're not professors that could go back and like the lost Sudanese boys who are graduates, who could go back and help build an educational system in Southern Sudan for them to move forward.
Okay. Well, that's a good question, and thank you, Emmanuel, for that question. It's basically what are you going to do with all of this? Professor Pogo, are you going back? What are your plans?
My plans, I have got a number of research projects to actually work on, to write a number of books ahead of in the coming years, and we'll continue to work on those research projects here, but I'll also visit Southern Sudan frequently. One of my goals is to write the Second Civil War in the Sudan. And I will be visiting Juba, I'll be visiting other cities in the South frequently to talk with leaders in the government as well as former combatants in the Sudan People's Liberation Army, perhaps interview them. But I'll also talk with education officials at the various universities in South Sudan, the five universities that have already been established, Juba, Rumbek, Dr. John Garang's University, Yambio, as well as Wau, and there are new universities that will actually emerge. So my contribution to South Sudan would be to meet with educationists, with education officials at the Minister of Education level or with academics at the universities so that we can actually together we can formulate a strong system of education for the new Republic of South Sudan.
Bull, you talked earlier about the clinic that you're raising money for and that you want to provide for your family and the people from your village. Do you ever plan on moving back there? What What are your thoughts about that?
Both of us, Jock and I, we are working tirelessly in order to provide a medical clinic in our village. And with the help of friends, we are able to see the progress today. So I'm not ready right now to go back to the village because there's need that have to be here so that we have to raise the money.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have enough money, there will be a lot of decision on the table. If I have to go there, I'm not, I did not study medical, so I could not work there as a doctor or a nurse. But my role is to provide support to the clinic. So there's a chance that we will be going back and forth. And we are not specific yet when we are going because we have not reached our goal. Our goal is $300,000.
$300,000?
Yeah. And we are now down to 70,000. So
you have just 70,000 to raise.
Yeah,
left.
We have raised 70,000.
Oh, you have raised 70,000. Yeah, you have 230 to go then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jack, what about you?
As the same thing as Paul said, so we are here to support that project, and without what has is being present and talk with a friend, talk with the. Some governments, institutions, and some non-profit organization that might give a hand to a clinic, then it will not puncture well. And we have a people over there in the ground that we assign them the responsibility to carry on, and we always communicated with them. We have a contact with them, and our friend is Steve Walker also is always on the phone and also Skype and also email with some people over there about the clinic. So we are not so nervous or worried to be on the ground, but the big part is what we are doing over here. So we can engage the people who might have a time, who might have a pace on what we are doing. And the people want to know what are the striking issues, what is the problem that the women in those villages are facing, their health and everything, the concern that they have to inform people about that one. So the message that we will do here is to be so informative of the mission that we established back home.
Tijani in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and let me just congratulate those gentlemen for the achievement they had accomplished. But my question is about the how sad it was for those guys to go through what they've been through. And the same thing is just happening again nowadays in Southern Sudan, which is the SPLM, which is the official army for the Southern Sudan, bombarding and burning villages in the north part of the Southern Sudan. I'm talking about the Unity State, and definitely they know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
There's still fighting going on, right?
Yes, it's basically the same civil war. It is, you can call it just the third civil war now, because this war is going against different tribes. Dinka tribe attacking other tribes because the other tribe basically fighting for the same thing everybody was fighting about, which is freedom.
Oxfam.
So if there is any way we can stop that from happening again, this is my question to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oxfam, the human rights group, reports that more people have been killed in Sudan in the first few months of 2011 than in all of 2010. Professor Pogo, what do you make of that? Is this something that could abate over time, or could it heat up even more?
I think it is something that the new Republic of South Sudan will be able to contain over time. It may not be immediate, but it will take time because the first president of the Republic of South Sudan will work closely with the Council of Ministers and the members of Parliament to address the problem in the Unity State and other parts of South Sudan. I think it will be in the interest of the new Republic of South Sudan to come up with a program that would actually require the disarmament, the removal of the weapons. Because there are so many weapons scattered across the south, mm-hmm. so it will be in the interest of the government to remove all those weapons in a very peaceful manner by talking to the people, by also asking the chiefs and the elders in those communities to engage the rebels in negotiations so that the weapons that the militia or the people who actually are fighting possess now could be removed from them, and they could also, and in return they could be not only given amnesty, but they could also be given some reward. It could be monetary reward for the fact that they turn in their weapons, so that they may eventually have to be given employment opportunities as well. And there's a lot of work that the South will have to do in terms of investment, in terms of creating jobs, because unemployment is very high.
Right.
And if all the people who are fighting now could actually surrender their weapons and become good citizens of South Sudan, they would be able to find employment and they would lead peaceful lives with their families. So I think it is a big challenge that the South will have to contend with, but it can be done. Those weapons can be removed, and the South will ultimately become a peaceful country.
What about the issue of oil? We only have about a minute left, Professor, but the oil's a big bone of contention, that who gets the profits from it. They're supposed to split it, but how do you think that's going to work? Because South Sudan, of course, has the oil wealth, but the pipelines go through the north, and we're running out of time, of course.
That's also another challenge which both sides have not actually addressed.
Right.
Clearly, so that's going to be a sticking point for the South. The North will have to sit together to come to an amicable agreement about the amount of money that the North should receive. Because at this point in time, the North does not really deserve 50% of the oil. Even if they have the pipeline, the South, I think, deserves to receive more of its own share of the oil, perhaps 70% or more.
Professor Scopas Pogo from OSU's Mansfield campus, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much for hosting us.
And also, Bol Awang, thanks for joining us again. Thanks for coming back to the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Anne.
And Jack Dow, Jack, nice to meet you, and thanks for coming to the show today.
Thank you so much, Anne.
And thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.